Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of August 29th, 2014. What does Labor Day weekend mean to you? The end of summer? Maybe it's sales on everything from cars to mattresses. On our show today, we want you to think about what inspired the holiday. And that's what you do every day. Your job. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. Think back to your first job. What did you learn from it? Mine was at a sandwich shop in Washington, D.C. when I was 17. I made food, ran the cash register, and bussed tables. We got in early, stayed late, and tried to have a sense of humor when the customers lost their temper. To this day, I remember the work ethic that that job taught me. Oh, and I still tip like crazy. We want to know what you learned from your first job. As always, you can share your story at MarketplaceWeekend.org or on Twitter at MarketplaceWKND. Now let's round up your economic week in 20 seconds.
More of us are paying our bills on time. A new report says credit card delinquencies are at a seven-year low.
In Detroit, the city's water department is back to shutting off supplies to residents who are behind on their water bills. Thousands of people, many of them poor, have already had their water cut off.
Suzuki has had to recall 19,000 of its mid-sized cars because of spider webs in the fuel lines. Turns out spiders are attracted to gasoline vapors.
Yeah, in the world of car recalls, spiders. Seems like a long shot, but there you go. All right, now let's talk about some of the other economic stories going on. And it's Labor Day weekend, so let's have brunch. We are out having brunch at the Pullman Kitchen on 2nd Avenue, and I am joined by Jessica Pressler from New York Magazine and Ben Walsh from Reuters. Welcome to both of you.
Hi.
Hi.
I want to start with the nature of work. It's a big topic, but it's Labor Day weekend. We're sort of thinking about the idea of work in America and how it's changed. And I feel like it is a profoundly different thing 5-6 years after the financial crisis than it was in those really scary days when people were losing jobs every day. Now it feels really different.
Now it's scary in a different way.
Yeah. It's still emotionally scary, but I don't know. It has this more of this kind of anxious quality to it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, like, one of the things I've been thinking about a lot lately is how, like, we've become this, like, economy of freelancers. Everybody's kind of, you know, getting by on small jobs, cobbling things together. What happens if you get sick and, like, you can't, like, do your TaskRabbit errands or... It creeps me out.
Jessica, you mentioned TaskRabbit. There's another company called Mechanical Turk, which basically lets you be a freelancer and do kind of menial data processing things, like be a moderator on Facebook and remove inappropriate photos for 3.5 hours a day or however long you want to. And between that and like the TaskRabbit thing of paying people to mow your lawn, it kind of feels like this weird kind of like post-Marxist dystopian thing where you like... No one has a job, but everyone's working.
Everyone's working, and then they're trying, you know, in their off time to do the thing that's going to make them as rich as, like, their boss.
Right, which is a super long shot, you know,
right.
thing. And we probably would all be better off if we just had, like, a salary and health care.
I want to talk about a big corporate story of the week, which is Burger King, run by a 33-year-old.
Really?
Tim Hortons, the Canadian, I guess we can call it, what, a Canadian Dunkin' Donuts with, you know, sorry Canadians, maybe coffee that's not as strong?
That sounds about right.
Okay. Is this a corporate inversion where a company goes overseas to pay lower taxes, or is this strategy because Burger King wants to grow in other places?
The first question, it is technically an inversion, but it's not really one that will help Burger King save a lot on taxes because they still have to pay U.S. taxes on all of the business they do in the U.S. It's not like a pharmaceutical company that can all of a sudden, you know, lease its patent to a UK-based company that then sells it to a Bermuda shell, that kind of a thing. So
Yeah, a lot of politicians are really angry about this. I can't tell if that feels just totally misplaced, if that's just kind of a fig leaf to yell.
I think that they should look at it like, we're actually encroaching on Canada, finally. We're going to take it over. It's the beginning of the colonialization process.
Of Canada. Yeah.
Take it back.
A
lot
fine.
Of space up there.
Yeah.
The one place that this will benefit Burger King from a tax perspective, and this reporter at BuzzFeed, Matt Zeitlin, did a really good piece on this, is future overseas growth will be taxed at a rate of either the Canadian rate or the local rate in the country, because Canada has these like bilateral tax agreements.
And Canada's rate is a little over 26%, but we should point out that like most big companies, Burger King included, do not really pay the nominal tax rate here in the U.S. They pay an effective tax rate, which is a lot lower.
Yes. So General Electric made headlines a little while ago, a year or so ago, for basically paying no U.S.
They paid nothing. Yeah.
No U.S. taxes for years and years. And they even referred to their tax accounting department as a profit center, which is probably not a good strategy from a public relations perspective.
Yeah, but they should call it a nonprofit.
But it was, but it was in fact what they were doing. It was an accurate description.
I want to bring up my one favorite weird story of the week, which is a huge bank in Russia, the biggest bank in Russia, is lending cats, apparently, to people who take out mortgages. Because, according to the newspaper, there is some superstition that if you have a cat walk through your new home before you move in, it brings you good luck. I don't know.
Where do the cats come from is a good question. And they actually come from employees of the bank. So it's really the bank taking risk, lending out its own cats.
Do you get a stipend for owning
sounds
a
like
cat?
Sounds like a former finance guy.
Everyone...
You're quantifying this as risk.
Everyone says that banks should take, you know, that if, you know, they should have, you know, skin in the game and all that kind of thing. And these people are really putting...
Fur in the game?
Putting their cats on the line.
Ben Walsh from Reuters, Jessica Pressler from New York Magazine. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. I mentioned my first job at the top of the show as a teenager in that sandwich shop. Our first jobs shape us and how we see work and the world. We sent Marketplace Weekend producer Raghu Manavalan out in Los Angeles asking, what was your first job and what'd you learn that stayed with you?
My first job in which I actually had tax withheld, actually, you know, my first real job was as a college student, I had work study, 95 cents an hour, 1968, and I just helped people find things in the magazine room at the local university I was attending. I was allowed to work 15 hours a week, but no more than that, and because I was a university student, and I had a wonderful woman was my supervisor. I'm not going to remember her name, but she was a sweetheart, an older woman, but very, very nice, very kind to me all the way through. It was a pleasure.
What'd you learn from it?
I learned that you could get by on very little money, much less then than now. At 15 hours a week, 95 cents an hour, I shared a two-bedroom, second-floor apartment in a pleasant house near the university with a friend of mine who had about the same amount of money as I did. And we had enough for the house and food, nothing more, but that was enough for that. I also learned that you, the first time it had never, you know, how would you think, you have a responsibility to what you're doing. It was weird. It was a very odd feeling. I didn't know that beforehand, and there all of a sudden I was thinking, well, I should get to work, you know, and that was a fun thing in kind of a funny, responsible sort of way.
What do you do now?
I still work in a library. I'm a law librarian here in Bunker Hill in Los Angeles.
So my first job was working as a sales associate for Old Navy in the children's department. That I don't want to work in retail for the rest of my life. That's the first thing I learned. And that, I guess, and this is probably not a very good thing to say about work, but no job is worth being unhappy over, period. no matter how bleak things may seem, and no matter how desperate you are for money, if you're unhappy, it's just not worth it. Don't ever feel like you're trapped.
So my first job was actually in the U.S. Army. So, yeah, right after high school, I enlisted in the Army just to get myself out of the area here in L.A. So I was a supply sergeant for the Army with 82nd and also a Ranger. The experience was culture shock in the beginning, but I fulfilled my goal of expanding my horizon in the Army, you know, exposed to different cultures, different ways of doing things.
Is there anything you learned from your time in the Army that you feel still relates today?
Absolutely. So the sort of the Army way of life, it's kind of crazy out there, but just the confidence that we gain from the military service, as well as just the tactics of how to deal with people. And when we're challenged with difficult situations, how do we carry ourselves, carries me every day.
So my first job, I worked at a Del Taco, and I remember I was making like $1.10 an hour. Do I have to say I was 16? I think I was 16. And it was pretty fun. I remember that we used to invent something to eat with the taco meat. Like we would like put it on like a tostada shell and just have a couple pieces of cheese with it. So that's about it. It was pretty fun. Sometimes some of the people through the drive-thru would give me a tip, like a nickel. And I thought that was like cute, but I thought it was great because in that hour I made $1.15.
What do you do right now?
Oh, I'm a legal secretary for a large law firm.
Are there any lessons you learned at Del Taco that you find applicable to your legal secretary job?
Whoa. Gosh, maybe just having fun at what you do. So that's about it. I don't know. What else do I want me to tell you about my first job?
For our next trick, we remotely turn Marketplace producer Justin Ho's apartment into an icebox.
Justin, at home, has his air conditioner plugged into this thing that looks sort of like a power strip. And with this app, we can control his air conditioner.
We'll reveal our technological magic next on Marketplace Weekend. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
The system goes online on August 4th, 1997. Human decisions are removed from strategic defense. Skynet begins to learn at a geometric rate. It becomes self-aware at 2:14 a.m. Eastern Time, August 29th. In a panic, they try to pull the plug.
This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to Tech in Real Life. Welcome back, Ben.
Thanks, Lizzie.
So we're going to mess with one of our producers' air conditioning, huh?
Yeah.
All right. I feel pretty good about that.
Yeah, me too. It's going to be fun. This is Justin Ho. He's producer for Marketplace Morning Report. And he has kindly given me the login for an app called Think EcoSmart. Now, what the app does is let you control devices, in this case, an air conditioner, from your smartphone while you're on the move or at the office, for instance. So
we're here in the office with this app, and we can control his home air conditioner.
Yeah,
huh?
We can control his home air conditioner. So we're looking at it right now. I've got the app open. This button up here in the top right, it says Smart AC.
Okay.
Now, Justin at home has his air conditioner plugged into this thing that looks sort of like a power strip, right? And with this app, we can control his air conditioner.
So from your smartphone, we can raise and lower the temperature on Justin's air. Oh. We can make it really hot or really cold in Justin's apartment?
Yep.
It's currently 82 degrees in Justin's apartment.
So, like, what do you think? 60, 65 degrees?
Yeah,
68.
All right, so I'm hitting the target area here. I'm hitting the up button to get it to 68 degrees.
Okay.
And now I've got it, and all I do right here is I hit save.
And we just set Justin's air conditioner.
We just set Justin's air conditioner.
That is so cool. So by the time he walks in the door,
boom,
68 degrees in the house. How did Justin get this thing?
Okay, so he actually got it from his power company, which here in New York is Con Ed.
What's in it for a power company?
Okay, so it saves power, potentially, for the, you know, if the user...
Yeah, but they make money when you use your power.
They do.
So what's in it for them? What's the angle?
Well, they want the data, right? They want all the information about their users, when they turn their ACs up, when they turn them down, and this helps collect that. But it also does something interesting. Now, do you remember what happened in New York City in 2003?
Absolutely. We had a blackout.
Major blackout. So power companies also want to understand when there's going to be stress on the grid. They want to avoid these sorts of things, and they'll avoid them with something called a conservation event. Now, when you opt into this program, you also opt into the power company being able to control your AC through this device.
Oh.
And theoretically, if things get too hot, we could have the power company say, you know what, we need to turn everybody's air conditioner up to, you know, 78
degrees. So we could turn all of New York City's air conditioners to 79 degrees,
right,
and therefore not stress the system.
Right, or turn them off.
Wait a minute, Ben. What if I don't want to give the power company the ability to turn off my air conditioner?
Totally understandable. And in this case, you can actually opt out of this, right? You can actually have full control over your own AC and say, look, I don't want you guys turning it off. You can override things, et cetera. So it's possible for you to actually be the person in total control.
So we're in New York, but where else is this happening?
So it's happening right now actually in a couple of other cities. One of them is Baltimore. Another one is San Antonio. This is sort of the beginning of the smart home, right? We've been talking about this for a while. People are just starting to use it or use sort of different devices, control things from their smartphones. And there's danger there of hacking and other things, right? But if it's successful and if it proves useful for the power companies, people in cities all over the country might soon be getting a message from their friendly power company saying, hey, would you like to opt into this service?
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech, thank you so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
How is technology changing your life? Let us know at marketplaceweekend.org or tweet us at MarketplaceWKND. And while you're at it, get some Marketplace Tech in real life. Download the Marketplace app. You can find it in the iTunes Store or on Google Play. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. One of the things that fascinates us on this show is how the economic rules we live by affect everyday life, which brings us to a story about vacuum cleaners. Yes, really. Starting September 1st, companies in the European Union can't make or import vacuums that generate more than 1,600 watts of power. Now, that's to comply with energy efficiency regulations. To figure out what this means on the ground, we called up Patricia Ware. She's an American who lives in Edinburgh, Scotland, where she sells vacuums.
Good afternoon, Radio Electrics.
Patricia Ware, welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Well, thank you very much, Lizzie. Hope your weather's good there. It's raining here in Scotland, as usual.
Tell me the name of your shop and how long you've run it.
Oh, Radio Electrics. My husband's been in business since the early 70s.
You sell vacuum cleaners. Explain to me what will happen on September 1st.
Well, the new regulations, I think, as you know, the suction of the machine is going to be reduced to 1,100 watts. Now, if you have a machine that's a 1,900 watt or 2,000 watt, the suction is really, really strong. And when you have pets with a lot of dog hair and cat hair, you need to have that suction. At the moment, we can still sell the machines because they've been manufactured prior to the September the 1st, you see, but they will not be able to manufacture after September 1st. They then would have to be reduced down to 1,100.
So I'm curious if you could maybe, since we're on the radio, test out a couple of machines for us and we could hear the difference between a 1,900-watt machine that will be banned under this regulation and the 1,100-watt machine that will be okay.
Okay, right. Just a second. I'll switch it on first and see if you can hear a difference.
Okay. Yeah, that's the big guy?
That's the big guy.
All right, let's hear the new guy.
Okay, and the next one's going to be the new Sanusi, which is an 1,100 suction.
Yeah, I can hear the difference.
Could you hear the difference, could you? And what did you think of the 1,100 one?
It's the difference between, say, a 747 and a smaller airplane.
Oh, right, okay.
Do you think this will make a difference to your customers?
Oh, I think so. I really do. I really do. Why they're doing this, I have no idea. This is this EU crap that goes on in Brussels. But never mind about all the racing cars that raise all the emissions in the air. That's okay. We're going to worry about a vacuum cleaner that's going to be on for an average household roughly in total a half an hour.
What does this mean for your business, do you think?
I really don't know. I really don't know what's going to happen because we're mostly on the repair side. See, a lot of people aren't really aware of suctions of machines. Sometimes it's up to the people that are selling the machines to explain things. And when you go into these big stores, they don't know anything about vacuums. They're just selling it. They haven't got a clue as to how the vacuum works, what type of filter system it has, you know, and you have to educate people. They half the time they don't even read the book. You know, when you say filter, what's that?
Patricia Ware, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're quite welcome, Lizzie, and all the best to everybody in America. Bye-bye now. Try it, won't pick it up. Take them life away. Try it, won't pick it up. Don't take your life away. Try it, won't pick it up. Don't try to take my knife away. And please don't you ask me if I love you.
Now we want to talk about a line of work, for lack of a better word, that's been struggling. Earlier this month, Pope Francis hinted that he may visit the U.S. next year. Francis is attracting a lot of attention to the Catholic Church, but the Church has a recruiting problem. A lot of its clergy is aging. It's happening in other faiths, too, as religious leaders retire. Some religions advocate student loan forgiveness as a way to attract young people. If they do significant community service, their loans can be forgiven under a federal program. We found one young person who has made religious work her life.
We're not the type of people that you run into in the everyday, you know?
That's Sister Colleen Gibson. She just took her vows to serve as a nun. She's 28 years old. We spoke on the campus of Chestnut Hill College in Philadelphia. It's a gorgeous sunny day, the first day of class. Not a lot of people out. You can hear cicadas making more noise than students. Gibson says, as far as nuns go, she's pretty young.
Even in like the young nun crowd, 28 could be on the young side of things. Really, young nuns, young sisters, range anywhere from their mid-20s into their 40s or 50s.
Describe for me what you're wearing right now.
Okay, so I am wearing... I got a pair of sneakers.
Yeah, you don't look like a nun.
No, I mean, I've got khakis on. I've got a t-shirt. It's the first day of classes here at the college. So it is fluorescent yellow. It says lost across the front. It's got a question mark. And so really, I have a, you know, shoulder-length haircut. The only thing on the campus that really distinguishes me as a sister from anyone else is that I have a little necklace on that is a cross with a globe around it. But otherwise, if you met me on the street, I would look like any other 28-year-old woman, really.
This is a momentous decision, and I would imagine one that you came to after a lot of thought and a lot of prayer. Walk me through how you did this.
Well, I grew up in a Catholic family, and so growing up, I didn't know any religious sisters. They weren't in my home parish, so the only sisters I knew were like Maria from The Sound of Music and Whoopi Goldberg from Sister Act. Those were my sister models, and I knew that I wasn't either of them. And so when I was probably about 13, I started thinking, like, in the back of my mind, this thought popped up, like, I think I want to be a sister. And then I immediately, like, ushered it out of my head. And I was like, that's crazy. Like, why would I want to do that? I've never met a nun. And, like, nuns are these women who, like, stereotypically, like, they're in a habit. They wield a ruler. Like, they're not overly happy unless they're spinning around on the tops of mountains. Like, but there was something. It just kept on coming back to me. And so one thing led to another, and I decided eventually that I was going to move to Philadelphia and get an experience of being with the sisters without making any, like, formal commitment. And so I came to Philadelphia, and I worked as a parish social associate. So I went out into people's houses, and I got to hear their stories and really figure out how to connect them with resources. And so that was the day-to-day life. And the more and more that I was with them, the more and more I sensed that it wasn't just something I admired in them. It was something that was deep within me, too. And so being able to make that connection and say, like, there's something about me that fits here.
When you decided to stay, that's a commitment that is not just spiritual, but that also requires thinking about how you're going to live, how you're going to afford to live. How'd you make the money part work?
Well, the first thing you kind of understand when you start hanging out with nuns is, like, simplicity is key. And, like, they take a vow of poverty. Like, we take a vow of poverty. And so at first it was a shift. I mean, going from working a full-time job and having a salary and being able to support myself and being able to really spend my money on whatever I wanted. It was a big shift to kind of, when I first moved to Philadelphia, before I had made any commitment, I was working on a stipend that was, you know, $100, maybe $200 a month. And so to go from, you know, being able to spend that in a couple of days to I'm going to need to make this last for 30 days was a huge shift. And you really, things are shared communally. It's like living with, you know, seven other roommates. So what is mine is my sister's.
Did you have student loans that you worried about?
I did not. I was lucky that my parents, when we were growing up, they taught us to save. So from first grade on, we had a savings account, and they made sure that we were provided for. That was understood when I was growing up.
You know, there's this question about getting young people into religious life and whether loan forgiveness can help do that.
I think that it would be an added perk to have loan forgiveness. But even as we look at religious life now, there are a lot of programs. The National Religious Vocation Conference is working on, you know, loan forgiveness and really how do people pay off their debts, and saying, like, it's a secondary thing. That if you come to religious life and you're a wonderful candidate, yeah, it would be really wonderful to be able to pay off your debts, because no congregations are struggling financially. Nobody wants to take on that debt. And lots of orders have candidates pay off their debts before they're able to enter. I don't think that, like, coming to the convent or, like, entering religious life.
The Catholic Church has had a rough few years, a rough decade. Sex abuse scandal trying to find its way. Is it hard to go out in the world and put a young face on the Catholic Church?
I think it's something that I've had to deal with all my life. I mean, really, as a millennial, like, this is the church that really I've grown up in. Like, I was in middle school when the sex abuse scandal first broke. And so it's something that I've had to deal with my whole life. But there's something new to, as having sister in front of my name, being a sister of St. Joseph. You come on as a representative of the church. And even though we are separate from the hierarchy, we are an independent thing, people assume, they meet you, and it brings with it a certain responsibility and, I don't know, a certain nuance about, you know, who we are and how we're connected to the church.
Do you want to try to bring more
young people into religious life?
Yeah, I think it's, for me, what will attract people to religious life is most authentically living this life. It was when I was with sisters and I saw them most authentically living, you know, poverty, chastity, and obedience, when they were really being true to who they were, that was what appealed to me. It's because of that deeper call to connection, that longing for something more in their lives. And that's when I talk to young adults, when I go out with my friends, when I'm in the bars or I'm out getting coffee. What is most appealing to people is that wanting a deeper understanding of who they are and who they're called to be in this life. And so tapping into that and saying, you know, who you're called to be might be a person who serves others and serves the church and has a deeper relationship with God that goes beyond just being in church on Sundays.
Sister Colleen Gibson, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And that brings us to the weekend number. Back to that news about Pope Francis's trip. It's going to cost a lot of money for the cities he visits. According to the New York Times and the Associated Press, the bill for a papal appearance can cost millions upon millions. Last year in Rio de Janeiro, the cost was estimated to be up to $160 million, or, as in the case in Madrid in 2011, as much as $53 million. All that money pays for security, logistics, and celebrations. Coming up, yeah, you're paid for one job, but does it really feel that way?
You're always on the clock. You're always expected to be there when they need you. But when you're on your time, they have no respect for that.
We respect you. Let's talk about it. Next on Marketplace Weekend from APM. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Do me a favor. Picture the job description for what you do now. Notice anything missing? Like the three or four other jobs you do every day?
I was on a salary. And so I just felt like I was putting in more hours than what was fair.
I wear many hats.
It's a lot of work, but, you know, it's proportioned enough for one person.
It varies, is all I can say.
I mean, it's just we are understaffed on purpose, so you have fewer people to work longer.
Yes, because we're understaffed.
So you're always on the clock. You're always expected to be there when they need you. But when you're on your time, they have no respect for that.
That seems to be the way things are going in my industry. Everybody's trying to make profits, and so that's what they do, is they cut back labor.
I'm married. I have three kids, and, you know, it's important for me to divide my time, you know, properly. Give that time to the kids, time to my wife. And if I'm just married to my job and they're taking advantage of me, I can't do that.
Since the recession, a lot of workers have had to cover for eliminated jobs and reduced headcount. But even though hiring is picking back up, people say they still have too much on their plate. Personal finance writer Farnoosh Torabi is here to give us some advice. She's the author of When She Makes More. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lizzie.
How do you navigate that moment where you're taking on responsibilities that, you know, maybe aren't on paper yours?
That's a really good question. I think it's an emotional spot to be in because you're feeling resentful. I think you want to take the emotion off the table and be strategic about the situation that you are in. If you're the last man or woman standing at your job, at least if you feel that way, and you think you're doing, you know, multiple tasks that are above and beyond what you signed up for, you need to let your employer kindly know that you're perhaps happy to take on the extra work, but that, you know, you want to be fair about it. I would say before you even go into that meeting, though, gather some research. Go to HR and find out what is your salary range. If you just got hired and you're making a starter salary, but suddenly you're taking on a lot more work, a lot more responsibility, find out what is the potential increase that you can earn based on that salary range. change. Use that information. Come armed with that information to your meeting with your boss. Say, look, I understand that, you know, times are tough here, that you're giving me more work. I'm happy to take on the responsibility. But I have found out that I am potentially able to make up to, say, you know, twice what I'm making now. I'm not asking for all of it now, but I think a 20 or 30% raise would be fair. And don't be afraid to ask for above and beyond your typical annual bump of 3 or 4% here, because your employer is doing without maybe two or three other employees. Giving you a little bit more money, a lot more money even, is better for them financially than hiring and training, you know, several new employees. So remember that.
One of our listeners wrote us, I have four jobs within the organization. I've been promoted three times, retained all of the responsibility of each prior position. I think employees feel like they're maybe not safe to voice those things. How do you gauge whether you are in a secure position to bring that up?
I think that if you have been given all this responsibility and that you've already been promoted three times, clearly your employer values you. When you voice, there's a way to do it that's wrong, frankly, you know, voicing emotionally, voicing kind of irrationally. And then there's a way to voice that's respectful, that's matter of fact, and that makes it more about the environment, the group, the company, rather than you. Make it less about how, you know, woe is me, and rather, you know, here's how I would like to steer things in a new direction to help everybody. Say, you know, I understand we have several projects coming up. I look forward to them. I'm excited about them. I think what would make it easier, better, more efficient for everyone is if I got the chance to perhaps work from home one day a week to, you know, avoid the long commute, to be able to have more focus and concentration in a quiet office environment. You know, making it about value added to your employer, that's what's going to ultimately help you voice in a way that's going to get you what you want and for your employer to feel good about it as well.
During the recession, a lot of people were stringing together multiple gigs, and some people still do that to pay the bills or because a freelance life, you know, is appealing to them. Do you have advice for people who are in that situation?
I do, and I can speak from in the trenches. I got laid off in 2009 and from a desk job, from a 9-to-5 full-time benefits-paying job. I was terrified, but frankly, it was the kick in the pants that I needed to really embrace entrepreneurship. And as a journalist, you're not really taught how to do that. But the fact of the matter was at the time that companies weren't really hiring full time. And so it was sort of out of a necessity that I had to realize this new career path. And there were some challenges that are still challenges. You know, it's managing your own retirement, getting your own health insurance, even, you know, having a budget for things like photocopying and phone calls, because, you know, those things we take for granted when we're...
When you're in an office, yeah.
When you're in an office. And so I would say if you want to be a gigmeister, and I highly recommend that because I think the flexibility outweighs so much, just be prepared for assuming those costs yourself, budget for those things.
Farnoosh Torabi is a personal finance expert and the author of When She Makes More. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Honestly, if they weren't cows, cows could probably be wearing Gucci loafers these days. Beef prices are at an all-time high, and that got us thinking, what do you do to MacGyver your grocery bill? We want to hear your food hacks. Let us know at marketplaceweekend.org or on Twitter at MarketplaceWKND. On next week's show, we'll hear your tips and learn some from the pros. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. We're talking about work this week, and you may have heard this statistic. Women apply to jobs when we fill 100% of the listed qualifications. Men, when they fill about 60%. Those numbers are cited as evidence that women need to be more confident in the workplace. Tara Sophia Moore thinks that's the wrong conclusion. She did her own study and wrote about it in the Harvard Business Review. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thanks for having me.
You busted some myths up here. Why did you choose to write this?
I was hearing a statistic that is quoted quite often in the media, that women apply for jobs only if they're 100% qualified, if they meet all of the listed qualifications, whereas men apply if they meet only 60% or 65 or 70% of the qualifications. And that statistic was being used to suggest that women need more confidence, that the reason they're making those decisions in their applications is a lack of faith in themselves. And I suspected that the reason was something different than that, probably something more complex than that, because I knew when I hadn't applied for jobs, faith in myself wasn't exactly the issue. And based on my work with women and women leaders, I suspected something more layered was going on.
So what did you find?
So I did a survey of about 1,000 respondents, both men and women. And in the survey, I asked them, when you haven't applied for a job because you didn't meet all the qualifications, what was the reason that you didn't apply? And I gave a range of choices. And in fact, the self-doubt issue, the lack of confidence issue, was the least common of the responses for both women and men. Only about 10% of women said that they didn't apply because they didn't think they could do the job well. And 12% of men said that. The most common answer for both women and men was, I didn't think they would hire me because I didn't meet the qualifications, and I didn't want to waste my time and energy. And this is a crucial distinction because it means that if women are showing this tendency to not go for it if they don't meet all the qualifications, it's not because they don't think they can do the job or they're feeling intimidated about the job. It's because they believe that the listed qualifications are in fact required and are going to dictate who is hired, and they simply don't want to waste their time. So in essence, it's not a mistaken perception about themselves. It's a perception about the hiring process.
It's a nuance, but it seems like it's a significant nuance in terms of how you look at the world.
Exactly. And I think it speaks to a number of factors that impact women in our careers in broader ways. One of them being that women were allowed entry into professional life because of the qualifications that we had, right? That was sort of the message of the moment for my generation, for my mother's generation. It was work hard, get the right degree, get the grades, do good work, and you can participate in this too. You can be allowed at the table too. And I think that paradoxically, that can mean that women actually see the workplace as more meritocratic than it really is, meaning decisions and promotions and raises happen. We might assume they happen more on the basis of the qualifications than they really do. And we may underestimate the ways that advocacy and networking, relationships affect what really happens, because those tools in the toolkit historically haven't been available to us. In other words, we're not going to get the plum opportunity because we're part of an old boys club. And so we come to rely more on having the right qualifications.
Hold on a second here, though, because you could make the argument that, you know, saying I didn't meet this full basket of qualifications is to some degree reflective of confidence, not confidence in your own worth as a person, but confidence in your ability to do the job and walk through the door and say, I'm the best employee.
Yes. So that would have showed up, however, in women saying, I think I can do the job well, and I'm going to apply. So we're looking at when they don't apply, what's the primary reason? Hmm. And what the survey showed is the primary reason is they're seeing the barrier as something external to themselves, something about the hiring process, rather than as about something internal to themselves.
When I looked at your survey, I was really struck by how much women seem to be following the rules. You know, when they're following the guidelines about who should apply, it's almost 2-to-1. They follow the rules and the men less so. It seems like we're socializing girls to, you know, color within the lines.
Yes. So one of the reasons on the survey, as you're mentioning, Lizzie, that people could choose of why didn't you apply was simply I was following the guidelines of who should apply, right? I was being a good rule follower. And that one, women chose as their primary reason for not applying twice as frequently as men did. And in fact, when you look at all the reasons in the list that had to do with believing in the rules, believing that the stated qualifications were required, that accounted for almost 80% of women's reasons for not applying. Yes, I think we do socialize girls to follow the rules more. And I think one of the ways that succeeding in school can actually be a detriment to girls is that success in school often, almost always, comes from following the teacher's rules, right? There isn't ever a moment when the teacher says, you know, here are the guidelines for the assignment. And if you do something really amazing that breaks a bunch of these guidelines, like, even better, you're going to get extra points for that. Most teachers, most students in traditional education environments don't get those assignments. So as girls, we've got almost two decades of conditioning in school and our time as teens and young women as well, where success comes from following the rules. And then we get out into the workplace and the game shifts a lot and no one is talking to us about how it's shifting.
Tara Sophia Moore wrote this piece for the Harvard Business Review, and she's the author of Playing Big. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Everyone has one, a story or a moment or a time when money changes your life. Writer Brian Finkelstein tells us a story about what happens when the bubble bursts.
The first time I made a lot of money, I was in my 20s, and I was broke. I was that broke in your 20s where you have sleep, you know, for dinner. You know, that feeling where you're like, oh, it's 8 o'clock, and I'm just going to go to bed because I have no money. And that's the way I lived my life. I was living in Brooklyn. I moved there because there was an art scene. I didn't paint or have any sort of artistic desires, but I wanted to be part of that community, so I moved there. I was living in Williamsburg, and I just would go to different jobs all the time, different places, make a few dollars an hour, and then leave, and then go on to the next one. And I got a job at this place, Kiehl's, which is a skincare store in the East Village in Manhattan, and I didn't know what it was. I'm not the type of person who uses skincare. And I got hired for $8 an hour to be the doorman. And that I could do. I went to Queens College, so I had enough education to say hello and goodbye. And I was doing that. I was making $8 an hour. And after like 6 months, I told the manager, Cammy, who kind of looked like a human Barbie doll, that I quit. I get a call at my house from this woman, Jamie Van Heidegger Morse, who owned Kiehl's, and she told me to stay, that she wanted me to train people on skincare. And I was like, no, that's not for me. I'm a schlubby, white, straight dude, and I worked in a place with fabulous, beautiful women and gay men, and they sold skincare. I couldn't. No one would want to buy it for me. I was not a poster for a good living. And she's like, no, but you represent a certain demographic that we don't have, and well, we really want you. Now, I was making $8 an hour, living hand-to-mouth, and she goes, here's what your salary will be if you start working, if you train at Kiehl's. We will pay you $90,000 a year, plus commissions, which came to over $100,000 a year. Then she gave me her American Express Black Card to go shopping in Soho and buy myself fabulous clothes, her words, a gym membership to Equinox, and then benefits along the way, including a 401k. And that was the first time in my life that I made a lot of money, and that just sort of changes the way you feel about things at that point, because then the art idea just went away. Like, any sort of integrity I had was bought that night and that phone call for the rest of my life. I worked at that job for 7 years, and it was great, and I made a lot of money, got myself out of debt. I paid my friend's rent. I was the guy in that group of artists that had money. And, you know, I lived in Williamsburg, and I worked in East Village, and both places were still cool and independent and mom and pop. And Kiehl's was this independent place that had been owned since the 1800s by this guy, John Kiehl and Irving Morse and this family. And it was very independent, and it was like an apothecary, and it was very New York. But then one day we held this meeting and she told us that L'Oreal had bought it, which was just like the worst, because L'Oreal, like in the cosmetics / skincare industry, that's like there's L'Oreal and Lancome and they own everything. You know, there's only 30 of us that made this multi-million dollar company grow. And when L'Oreal took over, they loved the brand of it. And then they did everything they can to change it. Because, of course, they were not going to pay people that much. So they just fired all of us. And slowly, as I looked around, there was, you know, Union Square was this beautiful place where there was very independent, like restaurants and stuff. And then the L'Orealization of New York happened. You know, there was two Starbucks, a Toys R Us, a Barnes & Noble, a Virgin Megastore. And it just happened overnight one day where it was all over. So I just spent all the money I had over the next 5 years pursuing a job as a comedian and a writer, and I started doing a lot of shows, and then eventually it moved to Los Angeles.
Brian Finkelstein is a writer and storyteller in Los Angeles. You can check out his upcoming tour dates at our website, marketplaceweekend.org. All right, that's it. That's Marketplace Weekend for this week. Next time, we'll have some brunch and learn about how you hack your grocery bill. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan, Jenny Amond, and John Sepulvedo. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We'll see you next weekend. This is APM.